Eisenhower, 11-19-29. I think everybody's ready, Mr. Baker.
Good morning. May it please the court, Mr. Koenig. My name is John Baker, and I am here this morning representing Kenneth Kidwell. The case that we present to you this morning is fairly simple and straightforward. Mr. Kidwell was employed, and actually is still employed, by the Danville Police Department. For the first 16 years of his tenure with the department, he was a very highly regarded police officer, was promoted to the position of sergeant. That all began to change in the year of 2008. Now, the question really is, could a jury determine that the reason that changed was because of a certain amount of speech that Mr. Kidwell made before the police union? As such, this case is brought under the First Amendment and is a fairly straightforward First Amendment retaliation claim.
Tell me in a nutshell, what's your best evidence that Kidwell's speech to the union motivated the discipline he received for his admitted violations of police policy?
Well, I'm not so sure that there were necessarily admitted violations in all of these instances, Judge Williams. I think that that's not an accurate statement. And I think that the arbitrator makes that clear. For example, the medical authorization, the fact that he had to sign that, the arbitrator, in the arbitrator's opinion, says, look, this was essentially a dispute that was well-founded. Mr. Kidwell was going along with what the union was telling him to do, and I don't believe that the arbitrator, in fact, I think the arbitrator specifically found that there was no violation of policy in that particular situation. So that's one example.
Are you talking about the getting this fitness exam?
Which, yeah, correct, Judge Mannion, the fitness for duty evaluation.
And one thing you said, he's still there, right?
Mr. Kidwell is employed by the department.
Okay, so he must have gotten the fitness at some point since then.
Well, while that's not in the record,
I know it isn't. I'm just asking because you said it, but otherwise,
he is employed. Right now, I believe that he remains employed in a light duty capacity. That they have placed him in essentially a desk position as opposed to a street sergeant position that he had held in the past.
And perhaps in my question, I wasn't trying to suggest that he admitted everything, but I still want to know what's your best evidence of the link, because that's what I have the trouble with, his speech and then this behavior.
Well, if the court and if Judge Williams, if you're looking for direct evidence saying, look, this occurred because of the speech, that doesn't exist. We are looking at a variety of different pieces of indirect evidence. The most significant of those, in my view, is the failure of the department to follow their policy. And let me explain to you what I mean by that. And I think that it's most significant when we talk about the chase, the accident that occurred. The department has a policy that says, whenever a police vehicle is involved in a vehicle accident which involves death, serious injury, or major property damage, the on-duty supervisor will request the accident to be investigated by either the Vermilion County Sheriff's Department or the Illinois State Police. That never happened in this case. In fact, there really was not much of an investigation. Sergeant Kidwell was never even interviewed about what occurred. This court has held in the past, for example, in the Rudin versus Lincoln Land case, that deviation from a rule or policy a jury can infer retaliation for that deviation. In this case, it makes perfect sense. The decision, the determination, or at least a jury could conclude, that the determination that they wanted was a finding that Mr. Kidwell violated some type of policy. That's what they wanted. However, if they had gone out, like their policy says, to the Vermilion County Sheriff's Department or the Illinois State Police, independent investigators, they might not have gotten that same determination that they wanted. Mr. Kidwell, this was an accident, and it was a serious accident. There were, I believe, 6 police cars that were seriously damaged in this accident. There were 2 employees who were injured seriously. One of the employees was off for more than a period of a year. The whole reason that this exists, that this rule exists, is to ensure some sort of fairness, some independence in an investigation. Here there was no investigation.
Wasn't there an explanation as to why this outside agency wasn't used and it was done internally?
Well,
some explanation given.
There has been some investigation given, some explanation given, Judge Castillo, and that explanation is, the public security chief didn't believe that it was necessary because there was no damage to a citizen's vehicle, nor was there any injury to a citizen, a civilian.
Well, that was at least the proffered explanation.
That's the proffered explanation of why it does that.
So your position is that you have to look at the entire mosaic of circumstances that occurred here.
That's exactly correct. And the other problem I have with that argument, and they argue, look, he can interpret the policies how he wants to interpret them. Mm-hmm. Well, that's true to a certain extent. I mean, there are always going to be deviations. Policies don't explain everything. But in this case, the rule makes no distinction between whether there must be a civilian who is injured. There were injuries. There was significant police damage. And the reality is, you would want an independent investigation if you're really going to try and find the real reason behind it. You would want that. That's a logical thing to do. And not only was there not an investigation, they never even asked Kidwell what happened. How can that be any sort of an investigation?
So going back to the beginning, speech, it was conceded that it was protected speech.
That was
not an issue.
That was not an issue that was raised before the district court.
So it all comes down to whether or not there is causation between what occurred, the disciplinary action, and the speech.
That is correct, Judge.
Do you believe that the district court judge used the wrong standard in evaluating this case?
Well, that's a hard question because at the time he probably used the proper standard. Mm-hmm. As subsequent case law has developed, I don't believe that it was the proper standard. When the Supreme Court decided, I believe it was the Gross case, there was some question about whether there had to be but-for causation unless a statute held otherwise. Mm-hmm. There were some decisions that came out of this court, and certainly decisions of a variety of district courts, that suggested, well, in light of that decision by the Supreme Court, there must be but-for motivation or but-for causation, even under First Amendment retaliation claims. That effectively trumped or overruled what the Supreme Court had done a long time ago in the Mount Healthy decision. Mm-hmm. Now, in October of this year, this court in the Green case said no, Mount Healthy is actually alive and well.
Right,
and
that was Judge Posner.
That was Judge Posner's opinion where he said we need to clarify here because there's been some misunderstanding. Mm-hmm. I think is what he said, and so I do believe that Judge McCuskey used the wrong standard. However, given the status of the law at the time, it certainly is understandable why he did that. But I do think that the question is, can a jury find that this was a factor? That kid
was a motivating factor.
Was a motivating factor.
How about this question? Can the but-for rebuttal to motivating factor be decided in a summary judgment proceeding?
I don't believe so because the burden of proof on that begins with the defendants. And I don't believe in a summary judgment proceeding, they can establish that, particularly in this particular case.
Okay. In this case, with the state of the record the way it is, which seems to indicate, for whatever reason, a downward spiral in Officer Kidwell's performance, Could but for be determined on summary judgment? If we were to accept all of these violations leading to the very last one, which is a refusal to divulge information with a very specific request, do you think it was appropriate for that but-for decision to be made by Judge Mukasey?
No. Mm-hmm. I don't believe that it was. I think that, you know, we have a situation here where really the legal issue is a sufficiency of the evidence. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we can look at this and we can say, well, what would a jury do? And we might say, and I think Judge McCuskey says in his opinion, look, mm-hmm. these decisions were reasonable, they were logical. Mm-hmm. Perhaps they were, and perhaps that's something that a jury would decide. But simply because a decision is reasonable and logical doesn't necessarily mean that it's not retaliatory. And I think that that's a significant point. I believe that in this particular case, a jury could look at this information. They could look at the fact that here you have Officer Kidwell, a 16-year veteran who, by all accounts, was doing a very good job. And all of a sudden, over a period of 8 or 9 months, goes from being an exceptional police officer to this terrible rogue police officer. So you look at that to start with. Then you add to that the fact that there aren't investigations that are done into these. We have outlined concerns that we had with the Uniformed Police Officers Discipline Act. These policies and procedures weren't followed. Based upon those things, we believe that there is sufficient evidence from which a jury could find, not has to find, but could find, that these actions were taken because of the speech, or in putting it in the other order, had Kidwell not said what he said to the Police Benevolent Union, these things never would have happened. We believe that a jury...
Even given the time lapse, it's what, about a year before the ultimate action is taken to...
Before the ultimate action is taken. There were two mm-hmm. instances of speech. There was a speech in February, mm-hmm. and that's sort of when... Right after that, things started going. Excuse me. Then there was another speech in August where he requested the removal of one of the command officers from the union. So there are really two separate instances of mm-hmm. speech that do have the common thread of him being very critical of the upper command of the police department. And what you have, and I think that, you know, Judge McCuskey ignores that's probably not fair, but he diminishes the opinion of the arbitrator. And I think that the opinion of the arbitrator is significant because, you know, Judge McCuskey repeatedly states that, look, these decisions were reasonable. Well, the arbitrator found that, no, they weren't. You know, he found that this termination never should have occurred and it should have been a total of a 7-day suspension. And so, under the arbitrator's ruling, they're not reasonable. Now, does that necessarily mean that they were retaliatory? No, I don't believe that it necessarily means that. But I think that it means that when a finder of fact is given the opportunity to thoroughly review what happened, the sequence of events, and how they occurred, it is permissible. Again, not mandatory, but permissible for them to find, yeah, that all or some of these were done in retaliation for what Kidwell said.
But there are a number of intervening acts in each instance, it seems. There are things what you would call it aberrant behavior or things that clearly you shouldn't have done, or hanging out with the informant, a trip out of the state with the so-called investigation. There were things that required some observation. And I know you're in your rebuttal time. I don't want to hold you up, but I think you can't discount those. They were definitely separate events that caused some reaction.
Judge Mannion, I agree that those events were there. But I also think that that's a great argument that should be made to a jury for a jury's assessment of what weight those should be given. And I disagree to the extent of the significance of those issues. The whole trip to Iowa, you know, the arbitrator found that it was something that was ill-advised. However, the arbitrator did not find that it was something that warranted termination. And there was no investigation that was done. He did take a confidential informant to Iowa. He took some pictures.
He wasn't terminated for those things.
No, he was. That was one of the reasons that he was terminated for.
Cumulatively.
Well, no, there were the charges of termination. There were three separate charges for termination. One was the Iowa trip. The second one was the issues involving the medical evaluation, and then the third one involved the automobile accident. Those were the three charges that were used to support the termination. Those were the three charges.
All right.
I see my time has expired.
I'll give you a couple minutes.
All right. I do appreciate the court's willingness to allow me.
I have a lot of questions for you.
Thank you.
Mr. Koenig.
May it please the court, counsel. He may have been a good police officer in the past, but this court must keep in mind that one of the principal reasons that charges were filed was the fact that he disclosed almost a year after his speech, his first incident of speech, that he was on Lexapro and Abilify, that he had been on those medications.
And that was treating what?
Well, we never got into that, Judge. That was the reason for the fitness for duty and for the disclosure.
Mm-hmm.
We don't know why, and so we asked that he submit to fitness for duty evaluation. He acknowledged in his deposition that by failing to disclose the fact that he was on those medications, he had violated department policy. Those are admitted violations. The first incident of discipline, the written reprimand that followed his speech in February, was an incident in which he accused the chief of being a headhunter, and he accused the chief of headhunting an officer in connection with other discipline in the presence of that other officer, Officer Pyatt. He said in his deposition, well, in retrospect, I would have spoken in a lower voice, or I wouldn't have said anything at all. That's certainly an acknowledgement of those violations. While he may have been a good police officer, these incidents that were brought to the attention of the chief were not subjective incidents. This is not where he simply looked at a police officer and said, I don't think you're doing the job appropriately. These are incidents based upon objective facts. These are incidents that were not manufactured. These were incidents that admittedly occurred. And the chief took some action. He was accused of being a headhunter or headhunting a police officer who had pointed a gun at a gangbanger's head in a restaurant because the guy blew a kiss at his wife. That's the subject that was being investigated, and he accused the chief of being a headhunter in the presence of that officer. The chief then gave him a written reprimand.
Now, what about this accident and the fact that there was not the independent review?
I think it has to be conceded first. And if you look at these court's decisions in Rudin and Giacoletto that he relies upon, not every departure from an established procedure or a required procedure can result in a reasonable inference that there's something afoot, that's something fishy. For example, under UPOTA, the Disciplinary Act, among the mandatory things are that the officer be advised who's going to be in his presence when the interview is conducted. The chief decides at the last minute to have his secretary present to take notes. Is that going to be, because he didn't tell him in advance, is that some fact from which a jury could reasonably conclude that there has been some discrimination? UPOTA requires that the interview be conducted in the police department. If a chief of police decides, I'm going to do it in City Hall, a separate building, 6 blocks away, because I want to be away from the prying eyes of other members of the department, is that something from which you can reasonably infer that departure from state law can result in a reasonable inference that there has been, that something is afoot, that there's some illegal discrimination or some illegal motive? So we have to start with the proposition that not every departure from established procedure can result in a reasonable inference. We look at the Rudin case. The Rudin case was a situation in which it was a suit by, I believe, a white employee. And the departures there were the departures that the court characterized as systemic. They said, listen, the policies required a committee meeting to determine who was going to be hired. The policy required a committee to rank order applicants to determine who was going to be hired. after the first pass, the first cut of prospective employees, an African-American was inserted into the group to be considered. That shows a direct connection, or in effect a setup, some predetermination. When under those circumstances, you can clearly say and logically those departures make some sense to show discrimination. The same thing in the Giletto case. They said there was no counseling given to the employee. There was no plan. This was a wrongful termination case. No counseling was given to the employee. There was no plan to try and improve the employee's performance. From those departures, we can conclude that you were setting up the guy to be fired. The same cannot be said for the departure from the accident investigation. First, the evidence, the determination of cause is made by a body consisting of police officers and I think civilians. It was that body that made the determination that the fault was that of the plaintiffs.
You say that there were, what, six police cars that were damaged?
Yes.
And then that two injuries, one of which was Kidwell's, I guess.
Correct.
And the other one a serious injury. I assume with their six police vehicles, there may have been six police officers involved. Is that fair to assume?
I thought it was three police vehicles, Your Honor. I could be mistaken. But the only serious injury was Mr. Kidwell. And because of his injuries, admittedly, he was never interviewed because he's in a hospital the entire time.
Well, I'm trying to look at that and reframe it. But
it was a pursuit, right? He was in pursuit
yes.
of someone.
Yes.
And essentially another officer hit his car.
Correct.
Because of the turn that he made.
Correct. Made a U-turn, I believe.
But let's go back, as I did with prior counsel. You concede that the First Amendment protects his speech.
Yes.
And the last speech occurred in August.
Correct.
Of 08. And then after that, every single time Officer Kidwell is disciplined, it has to do with him being an aggressive police officer. Could you put it in that category? One, he takes the informant on this trip to Iowa.
Well,
that occurs the very next month.
I think what the best way to characterize his conduct is he's not satisfied with what the department does, and he goes and decides he's going to do things on his own.
Okay. But that's what he did in September. He took the informant to Iowa.
Correct.
He's not doing it for his personal reasons, but he's trying to be an aggressive police officer.
And investigate a shooting outside of his jurisdiction.
Okay. And then the crash that occurred that same near the end of the month, end of September?
Crash was in the middle of September.
Okay. Again, he is putting aside his personal safety and goes out there, is aggressive in this pursuit, and gets hit by this other police officer and is blamed for the crash after your department doesn't follow this procedure of bringing in an outside agency to look at it.
That's correct. But I would ask, Your Honor, blamed for the crash by whom?
Mm-hmm.
Not by any of the defendants. No showing of any connection between the defendants and the advisory board consisting of fellow police
okay.
officers and citizens. We didn't set it up.
So then
the report was done by the insider.
The report was done.
The board reviewed was done by the insider, and that's the only evidence they had.
Right. And there's no connection, no suggestion that the insider somehow dummied up the report.
Okay. No, I'm not saying that.
Right. I just wanted to clarify.
We're just going through the chronology. So then the next thing that happens is the officer himself discloses that he's on Lexapro and Amplify.
Correct.
He discloses.
Correct.
It isn't that the department finds out.
Correct.
And then the department sends him to get evaluated.
Correct.
And then it goes from there.
Correct.
So why couldn't a reasonable jury look at that and say what is happening here is you had an outstanding officer who got promoted to sergeant who all of a sudden is being really taken to the carpet and ultimately asked to be relieved of all duties all because of the speech that occurred in August?
Well, I think simply because, as this court's repeatedly said, simply because events may follow free speech mm-hmm. is insufficient to warrant a conclusion. That standing alone is insufficient to warrant mm-hmm. a conclusion that speech is a motivating factor. I mean, there's case law that says we don't care whether the police chief is, mm-hmm. the language is used, brimming over with unconstitutional mm-hmm. wrath, mm-hmm. that he doesn't like what the speech says. Mm-hmm. That's insufficient for a court or for a jury to conclude that his speech was a motivating factor. We're simply saying that there is no mosaic. We have instances, not that the chief of police didn't go out and look for problems.
Mm-hmm.
He wasn't out, quote, headhunting. These are incidents that were dumped into his lap. I mean, somebody calls from Iowa and says, do you have one of your officers out here investigating this matter? We're thinking of charging him with interference with an investigation. Mm-hmm. What's the chief supposed to do under those circumstances? Turn his head? We submit that these are instances, and a police officer, I mean, you point out aggressiveness. I don't care whether it's aggressiveness or not, but these are instances that the chief of police can clearly look into. Nothing happened in connection with the Iowa incident. It turned out to be a basis for the charges that were filed against him, one of the three charges. You point out the finding of the arbiter. The arbiter whacked him with 10 days. 10 days in the police context is a lot of discipline to impose upon a police officer. She specifically found that there were rule infractions. Now, the infractions didn't warrant termination in her part. Now, she didn't feel that termination was appropriate. She felt that he acted reasonably in withholding consent. Well, as the Illinois Supreme Court found a couple weeks after her decision, you know, there's some serious question as to whether or not that order of the chief was legal. I think under the Johnson case that we submitted, you know, the chief could legally order somebody to disclose the reasons to disclose a psychological report, because under the Johnson case, that examining physician is not a treating physician, so no privilege attaches under Illinois statute.
Let me ask you this. Were the sanctions imposed on Kidwell for his violations of procedure harsher than those imposed on other officers?
Well,
what's the record on that?
There is nothing in the record. There is absolutely no comparable to show how the chief of police handled other instances of being disparaged, how he handled other instances of police officers going outside their jurisdiction, how he handled other instances of a police officer bringing a bomb from Chicago to Danville, how he handled other instances of police accidents, how he handled other interviews under UPOTA. There's absolutely no comparables or whatever to create the mosaic that this court has said under the direct method would be necessary.
Do you believe Judge McCuskey applied the right standard in deciding this case?
I think, yes, under our arguments he did, because under the Green versus Dorff case, first, we never argued that the but-for analysis. Our argument in the district court and our argument in this court is there is no evidence to establish that the speech was a factor or a motivating factor. We did not raise the Mount Healthy argument, the but-for argument, in response to Your Honor's question as to whether or not that can be decided by this court. I think the standards governing Rule 56 and Rule 50 are the same. No reasonable jury could conclude otherwise. So, I mean, if summary judgment can be granted in favor of defendant, why can't summary judgment be granted in favor of defendant on an issue where the defendant has a burden of proof, if no reasonable jury could conclude otherwise? If there are no further questions, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Koenig.
Thank you.
I said I'd give you two minutes, Mr. Baker.
Thank you, Judge Williams. I do appreciate that. I just want to very briefly respond to a couple of factual statements by Mr. Koenig. As far as what was involved in the accident, and this can be found in our appendix at page 32, where the arbitrator is outlining exactly what occurred. And it's important. I think he said Mr. Kidwell was the officer who was injured. Kidwell was injured, but there was another officer, Officer Moody, who was also injured. And, in fact, Officer Moody testified in Kidwell's favor in the district court in this case. However, it says that the incident resulted in two officers, including the grievant, being injured, a cost of $50,000 to replace patrol vehicles, and about $8,000 in damage to a civilian vehicle. So in addition to the damage done to the police vehicles, there were civilian vehicles, civilian property that was damaged. I also think that he stated that there was a 10-day suspension, just off by a little bit. It was a 7-day suspension, and that can be found at page 63 of our appendix. So if there are not any further questions, we would ask that this court reverse the decision and remand it for a full jury trial. Thank you.
All right. We thank both counsel for their final argument and well-written briefs. We'll take the case under advisement.